Bus drivers, mechanics, and other union workers in Tucson continue striking today. It means service is limited and is hurting people who need to be mobile.
You're going to have people facing electric turnoffs, even possible evictions and homelessness because of not being able to get into their appointments due to the strike.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Navajo farmers and ranchers try to get answers from the EPA after the mine spill. Could we be trading in some of our paper money for coins?
And how new venues for writing have changed the craft.
It gives voice to people who previously would not have had access to a large audience.
Plus, protecting snowbirds' nests during the summer, and we just want to bang on the drum all day.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. Very quick check of traffic. There's an accident on I-10 westbound blocking the shoulder at Central. There's also an ozone health watch in effect for the Phoenix area today and into tomorrow. We're looking for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 111. 108 was yesterday's high. 105 is average for today. Sunny skies again tomorrow with a high of 111. It is 111 degrees right now at KJZZ.
There will not be a moratorium on new farming in parts of southeast Arizona. KJZZ's Will Stone reports a group of growers had asked the state to do so out of concern for the groundwater supplies there.
For months, farmers in Cochise County had been waiting for the Department of Water Resources to issue a final decision. 16 growers in the San Simone Valley, east of Wilcox, contend that the aquifer there cannot sustain any additional agriculture beyond what's already in production or slated to be. This is the first time farmers have ever petitioned the state to establish what's known as an irrigation non-expansion area. Mark Cook is with Whitetail Creek Orchards and supported the moratorium. He's disappointed with the state's decision, which he says only took into consideration the current rate of pumping.
We have our eye to the future, and we don't think if too many acres are developed that there will be a sustainable supply for the future, and so we've tried to be proactive.
But most of the comments the state received were against new regulation, in part because that would devalue land and limit opportunity for some farmers. While much of central Arizona has restrictions on groundwater pumping, most rural areas, including the San Simone Valley, do not. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Officials with the University of Arizona Cancer Center at the St. Joseph's Hospital held a ceremony today to mark the opening of the new facility in downtown Phoenix. KJZZ's Carrie Young was there and has the details.
The new center is one of about 40 other facilities nationwide, designated as a comprehensive cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, which means it has a research focus and offers clinical trials to patients. City Councilwoman Kate Gallego was among several elected officials to attend the ceremony. She says the facility is the latest addition to the Phoenix Biomedical Campus downtown, which is a larger city effort to invest in the medical and bioscience industries.
We're trying to build an innovation-based economy that will have a wide variety of different sectors so that if one sector, such as housing, has a downturn, we have a lot of other areas where jobs are continuing to grow.
Medical staff will begin seeing patients at the new cancer center on August 24th. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Tucson bus strike has been going on for more than a week, leaving tens of thousands of residents struggling to get to work, and optimism is not high that there's light at the end of the tunnel to bring it to a close. Andrea Kelly, reporter and producer for Arizona Public Media in Tucson, joins us with an update. Andrea, is there any news to report?
Essentially, Steve, no news is the news. We're on day 8 today of the strike, with limited bus service running and no talks scheduled between the Teamsters Union that represents the drivers and the maintenance workers for Tucson's SunTran bus system. No talks scheduled between the Teamsters and SunTran, the private management company that runs that system.
Is there any indication, would there need to be, that the mayor, members of council, anything like that, would try to twist some arms?
Well, I actually just interviewed City Councilman Steve Kozacik, and he said the city actually cannot get involved in this at all. Because federal funding is used for the bus system, the city council and the city is prohibited from having a role in these wage negotiations, which is, wages is one of the issues on the table here. The city is prohibited from getting involved because of that federal funding. So there is no arm twisting on behalf of the city in this situation right here. Tucson has a bus riders union, which is an informal organization that has been supporting the drivers and wants to see an end to this. And I think there is a role that that organization could have in trying to bring the parties together.
And you mentioned wages as a major issue. What are some of the others?
SunTran has offered a wage increase, a raise for the entry level bus drivers, but the Teamsters are requesting raises for people at all levels of the job, except for those who have already reached maximum pay. And SunTran says that's just too expensive. There are two other issues of safety that are on the table here. One is driver safety. There have been, depending who you ask, almost two dozen assaults on drivers in the last year or so, SunTran drivers here in Tucson. That's a range of things from, say, somebody throwing a drink or their bus ticket at a driver. That can be an assault. But there was also a driver who was stabbed on the job. So it's a very wide range of what that means. And the union is concerned that there are not enough effective safeguards in place for driver safety. Now, SunTran says it has already agreed to all of the union's recommendations regarding safety. So, and the other safety issue is a development of mold at one of the maintenance facilities. The union is concerned that some mold has been developing during the rainy monsoon season, humid monsoon season, and that it's actually a public health issue and has caused respiratory and health issues for some of the workers, and that that mold in that maintenance facility has spread to some of the buses and therefore could be even a bigger safety issue for riders. Now, on that issue, SunTran says it's working with mold remediation specialists to work on that problem, that they're actively working on it.
Obviously, it's a significant problem. Is this in some ways bringing some aspects of life in Tucson to a standstill?
SunTran is offering eight of its dozens and dozens of routes on a limited schedule Monday through Friday during this strike. They've taken some of their managers who were trained to drive buses and are running some routes. So I would say all of the 66,000 people who usually ride a bus in Tucson on the weekdays are affected in one way or another, from having to wait longer or not having a ride. There's many bus routes, and so to be down to just eight means it's much more difficult. If you can get on a bus, it's harder to transfer. We heard stories from people this week who it's taken them hours to get to work because they're having to walk halfway and take a bus some of the way. One of the reporters here talked to a woman who lost her job a few months ago and is actually getting in her car, driving to bus stops, and just asking people if they want to ride. Just to try and help out. Wow. She said she was impacted by the strike in 2010 and knows how hard this can be. And since she's not working, actually, she put it as a potential for some good karma.
Andrea Kelly, reporter and producer at Arizona Public Media in Tucson. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
The strike has been affecting Tucson residents trying to get to work, school, and other appointments. To get a sense of how bus riders are being impacted, we called Diana Garcia. She's the supervisor of the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Grants at the Rio Nuevo One Stop Center in Tucson. It offers services like job development, adult basic ed, utility assistance, and help with housing.
Well, we've had cancellations at the front desk for several of our or appointments with the Community Action Agency. They're the ones that provide the emergency rental and utilities. So we've had several folks call and cancel those appointments. And the problem with that is we have a bottleneck of people calling in. And once they cancel appointment, the likelihood of getting another appointment in a timely fashion is difficult. And therefore, you know, you're going to have people facing electric turnoffs, even possible evictions and homelessness because of not being able to get into their appointments due to the strike.
How have you noticed that the effects are changing as the strike has gone on? I mean, are you seeing more cancellations now than maybe you did early on, or are people maybe able to find alternate ways to get places now that the strike has been going on for a bit?
That's the interesting part, because I did notice that we do get cancellations mainly for those utility appointments and rental. But for the orientations that we had, we've had only a few cancellations, and our lobby has been, since the strike, pretty full. So that's been kind of unusual. So that tells me that folks are finding a way, even if it's walking. I mean, on my way to work, I see a lot of people walking. I see a lot of bikes. Yeah.
Do you have a sense of what percentage of the folks who come to use your services rely on public transportation?
I would say a huge percentage in my office. We serve individuals who are at or below poverty level. So the majority of them depend on transportation.
Have you heard from folks who do make it to your office that they're having trouble getting to jobs or doctor's appointments or other kinds of appointments that they have?
Yes. What we're hearing is the buses that are running are only running hourly. And if they're full, they have to wait a whole nother hour to get on the bus, which makes them late to their jobs and to any appointments such as doctor appointments, which then they're being turned away from the doctors. And then in terms of employment, they're in jeopardy of losing their jobs.
Have you heard of anybody losing their job already because they haven't been able to get there?
Not yet. From the most part, we've heard that employers are, you know, some employers are understanding, but I can imagine that most of them aren't. But I have not heard personally from anyone.
What's your gut feeling about how your clients will be affected going forward if this strike continues?
Not good. I've even seen children walking with their backpacks to school because there's no transportation and these are young children. I just don't think it's a good situation, and I feel that the city of Tucson should do something. That's what I would like to see, is some type of resolution as to somebody doing something to get these folks to where they need to go, because if not, you're going to see more homelessness, and it's just devastation across the board.
You think things will just get worse if the strike doesn't get resolved soon?
Yes, I do.
Diana Garcia supervises the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Grants at the Rio Nuevo One Stop Center in Tucson. EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy has been in Farmington, New Mexico today, meeting with community and tribal members, among other people, about the agency's response to the release of wastewater from Gold King Mine. Last night, there was a community meeting at the Shiprock Chapter House in Shiprock, New Mexico, on the subject. More than 300 people showed up, mainly farmers and ranchers who live along the San Juan River. KJZZ's Laurel Morales was there, too.
So there's more than 750 farming families that live along the river. They farm about 25,000 acres of land there and take care of about 60,000 head of cattle.
Has the spill reached them already, or are they concerned about it potentially getting there?
So it's no longer visible, but we're told that it has passed Farmington, and it's probably close to Lake Powell. So that's what we know about the plume, if you want to still call it that, even though it's not visible.
What specific concerns did the farmers and ranchers have?
They're upset. There was time for questions and comments, and one elder got up to speak and was just so overwhelmed with despair that he couldn't. He just kept saying how hurt he was and broke down. And it's more than the money. That's, you know, what I realized yesterday. Yes, this is their livelihood, but the Navajo are spiritually tied to the earth. And when the river is desecrated like this, they're deeply hurt. People are also angry. This isn't the first time the Navajo have been wronged by the federal government.
Did the EPA emergency responder who was there have anything to say that put fears at ease or allayed any concerns?
He did apologize. He said he wanted to make this right. He didn't have a lot of answers in terms of data. The one hopeful thing he did have to offer was that the EPA is paying to haul water to people, not only drinking water, but irrigation and water for livestock.
Did you get a sense of what the farmers and ranchers are doing in the meantime to try to keep their crops and livestock alive?
Some are driving great distances to other water sources to haul their water to crops and cattle. You know, that costs gas money. They're praying for rain. But you have to remember that we're in a drought.
Does this seem like it's going to pose a long-term problem to these folks? I mean, is there an end in sight to the problems that they're dealing with?
The short answer is we don't know yet. They're waiting for more test results.
Right now, several intakes have been shut down. Irrigation canals are dry. We don't know if the season is over. The EPA, they've issued $500,000 to deliver water for irrigation and livestock in New Mexico. There's also talk of diverting water from other sources. The Navajo agricultural products industry is based up there, and they have a different source of water. But as we know, water is scarce in the Southwest.
You'd mentioned that for the Navajo farmers and ranchers, this isn't all about the money, but the money's got to be a pretty big part of it to them, doesn't it?
Yes, for sure. Unemployment is at 50% on the Navajo Nation. A lot of people rely on this food as their food. They are growing crops not only to sell, but they rely on the money for sure. And we heard a lot about that yesterday. They can file claims with the EPA, but there's some confusion as to whether they would be just a one-time reimbursement this year. We don't know yet what the future holds for this part of the country and farming.
KJZZ's Laurel Morales in Flagstaff, just back from a meeting in Shiprock, New Mexico. Laurel, thanks.
You're welcome, Mark.
Coming up, how switching to the dollar coin could pay off.
This saves money because it's much easier to produce coins that last 30 years as opposed to currency bills, paper bills, that only last a few months.
The other side of the coin, giving up the paper dollar. That's ahead on the show.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. You do not have the go-ahead to have outdoor activity today. It's going to be a scorcher. It's already up to 111 degrees, and an excessive heat warning is in effect for us until Saturday, when there's a possibility of a late afternoon thunderstorm. But that's still a couple of days away. In Valley traffic, accidents on I-17 southbound at I-10. That's restricted the off-ramp. And there's also a collision blocking the shoulder of the 60 eastbound at State Route 87. It's 220.
KJZZ is supported by Valley Metro, working to benefit the community, including those who rarely use public transit, by creating sustainable jobs through further development of the transportation system. ValleyMetro.org/connected.
Earlier this week, Scottsdale-based Rural Metro Corporation was purchased by Colorado's American Medical Response, or AMR. Experts say it shouldn't affect the kind of ambulance service Arizonans receive, but the merger does leave a lack of competition. Arizona's former state health director, Will Humble, says the current system could use some tweaking.
The way the system is set up, if someone is already holding a license for a geographic area, they have an opportunity to contest somebody else getting a license for the same area. And so the way the statutes are set up in the state, it provides for this acrimonious process in which the agency that's the regulator, right, needs to both listen to the applicant, that person that wants a new certificate or license to transport, but also the current holder. And so what usually happens is that that ends up in a administrative law judge is sort of purview, and that takes about 18 months of the 2 years. And so, you know, one of the things that I heard over and over again as frustrations from fire chiefs and city managers, especially in the urban parts of the state, was that there were so many barriers to entry for a fire service, for example, that's very qualified and has financial backing. They still can't get a license or a CON because the process takes so long, and the way the statutes are set up, it really stacks the deck against the new applicant in favor of the person who's already holding a certificate.
So what changes to you would make sense, and are they viable?
One of the things that to make sure that as the policy discussions happen is that we consider both urban and rural Arizona, because those are two very different situations. in the rural parts of the state, you want to make sure that at least somebody is going to pick you up wherever you are. Even if you're in Dateland, you know, on I-8 or whatever that is, if you get hurt there, you're going to have ambulance service. And on the other hand, it needs to be a flexible system so that you get incentives for better performance in the urban parts of the state. And so the policy discussion really needs to be a balance that works both for rural Arizona, but also provides additional incentives for better competition in the urban parts of the state.
Are we set up well enough for that right now? And if not, why wouldn't we have seen some of the changes you brought up?
From a purely a public health perspective, right? I think the service as it is adequate. But I don't think there's anywhere in the state where there are public health hazards that are as a result of the current certificate system. Having said that, the system currently has barriers to entry, which limits competition in the urban parts of the state. And so there are city managers and especially fire chiefs throughout the valley here who would love to have a certificate of necessity so they could improve service to their political jurisdiction, city.
So with Rural Metro getting taken over, should there be any concern that even though the company taking them over is a professional company, from what I've read at least, has a good reputation for this, but do they have familiarity with this area? We always hear about, you know, don't worry about monopolies, don't do it. But in a case of public health, should we be concerned about that?
Well, I mean, I'm a firm believer that competition improves performance. Mm-hmm. And when you have one vendor and one entity that's capable and authorized to provide the service, then, you know, what the redress for poor customer service is really not there. And so when in early January, hours before the Ducey administration took over, I approved the certificate of necessity for AMR. I didn't know if I was going to be there on Tuesday, so I made sure I did that on Monday. And one of the things that I felt really good about approving that certificate was that, okay, at least now, when cities want to go out on an RFP, a bid for ambulance transport service for their city, now they're going to have two folks that apply to that RFP, and they'll have an opportunity to sort of select this vendor or that vendor depending on their response. But when you only have one authorized ambulance service, you're going to get one bid, and so it's kind of a take it or leave it kind of thing. Like we saw with Rural Metro. I mean, they went bankrupt when I was running the state health department. Yeah. It made me really nervous because you don't know what's going to happen. And then you've got nobody to turn to if they actually pull up their stakes and leave the state. We really need to do some planning up front so that we don't put ourselves in a situation where we have a major ambulance provider that ends up declaring bankruptcy and we put ourselves in that same situation again.
Will Humble, former state health director. Will, thanks.
Thanks.
But is there any momentum to modify state statutes or change anything about the certificate of necessity or licensing system? Dr. Randall Fries is a trauma surgeon at the University of Arizona Medical Center and a state representative. Dr. Fries, is there potential trouble because the state doesn't have more ambulance transportation providers?
Having fewer providers does make one wonder, you know, is that going to affect the level of service or the quality of service? But one must take comfort in the fact that there are mandatory regulations, response time, uniform standards, and things like that that must be met by these companies that apply for the certificate of need to be able to operate an ambulance in a particular area.
You have a unique perspective, as we mentioned, being a trauma surgeon. Any experiences that you've seen that give you pause, or do you feel like the service being provided certainly in southern Arizona, in the Tucson area, is good? I know there are some concerns whether there's enough to actually spread it all around. The urban areas of the state and the rural areas of the state are all being served equally.
I personally feel that the service that I see delivered has been excellent. I do have interaction with pre-hospital providers when I receive trauma patients through the emergency room. The other point that you bring up is rural versus urban. I mean, I certainly believe that an urban area can be served well by ground transport. In fact, sometimes if you're within 15 to 30 miles of the Level 1 Trauma Center, you're better off getting ground transport because there is a certain amount of time required to start up the process of air transport. But then in the rural areas, that's where air transport and air ambulance has filled in the gap and decreasing the response time to getting to that patient and then getting that patient to the trauma center where they receive their care.
So should there be, will there be, any changes to state statutes on this?
Just this past session, we did have a bill where we did look at the certificate of need, and we increased the time limits on the director's ability to give out a temporary certificate of need from 90 days to 180 days. And then that could have been, that will now be able to be done three extra times so that they can be sure that they're filling that certificate of need with the proper company that can provide the service. And again, more than one company can have a certificate of need for the same area.
State Representative and Southern Arizona Trauma Surgeon, Dr. Randall Fries. Now for a story that holds some currency. Actually, it's about how we hold our currency.
A new push is on, again, to get rid of the paper dollar and replace it with coinage. This month, Arizona U.S. Senator John McCain introduced the Unified Savings and Accountability Act, which includes this latest proposal to ditch the dollar bill in favor of the dollar coin.
There are some staunch proponents of this plan. KJZZ's Phil Latzman talked with a former Arizona lawmaker who's been fighting for the change to our change.
Jim Colby represented Southern Arizona in the House of Representatives for almost two decades. He now works for a Washington, D.C. think tank, as well as serving as co-chairman of the Dollar Coin Alliance, whose goal is to modernize U.S. currency. Colby says the idea still makes sense.
Well, the Dollar Coin Alliance follows on with something that I started when I was in Congress, actually more than 20 years ago. We started this idea of introducing legislation to substitute a dollar coin for the dollar bill, the currency. And the basic argument for it is that it saves the taxpayers a lot of money, somewhere between $4.5 billion and $14 billion over the next 30 years. Now, that's not a lot in the terms of the total federal budget, but there's also not a lot of programs you can think of where you can save money and not either cut somebody's benefits or cost the taxpayers any money. And this saves money because it's much easier to produce coins that last 30 years as opposed to currency bills, paper bills, that only last a few months.
And this has been attempted before, of course, on many different occasions. I can remember back to the late 70s and being a numismatist myself, having the Susan B. Anthony dollar, which didn't catch on. And now I know in recent years there have been other attempts to for dollar coins, which haven't caught on either. What makes this the right time if it hasn't worked in the past?
Well, you're right. It hasn't worked in the past. And the basic reason it has not worked in the past is because we have tried to keep both in circulation, the paper dollar and the coin dollar. You don't get a choice between having a quarter that's made of paper and a quarter that's made of a coin. You get the coin. And it's the same thing. Every country that has done this, made this transition, has found that you make the transition as quickly as possible. And once you do, people are quite satisfied and quite happy to have the coin currency. The Canadians love their loonie, as they call it, or the toonie, which is the $2 coin. And in euro, the euro coin as a dollar is the same kind of thing. So it's really, if the key thing is to make the transition as fast as possible. And the reason why it's now, I think, much more acceptable is because we really are looking everywhere in the budget that we can to find ways to save money. And you know, it's not easy to point to places where you can save money and not actually cost the taxpayers any money or cut anybody's program.
Arizona obviously is the copper state. You represented it for so long in the U.S. Congress. Would something like dollar coins make sense for the copper state and for the mining industry here?
Well, you know, when we first started looking at this legislation, it was way back when I first came to Congress in the 1980s, and the copper industry was pretty flat on its back, and that was part of it. But I have to say, over the last 20, 25 years, I've not had any conversation with anybody in the copper industry. This is such peanuts in terms of small amount use of copper that it really doesn't have any real impact on the copper industry.
Which leads me to my next question. Since we are less and less dependent on those pennies, couldn't we melt them down and make them dollar coins?
Well, the pennies don't have any copper in them. You need to have, because you can't use pennies in vending machines. But the pennies, The pennies certainly, I think, don't serve any real purpose any longer, but that's not what the Dollar Coin Alliance is about. We're about modernizing the currency and trying to add the dollar coin there. But the issue of getting rid of the pennies, I think, is a different issue. But I think it also goes along with modernizing the currency.
That's former Arizona Congressman Jim Colby, now co-chairman of the Dollar Coin Alliance. And while he maintains the copper industry has no stake in this, many of their members are in the business, including the Arizona Mining Association, Copper and Brass Fabricators Council, Copper Development Association, and Global Brass and Copper. And for the record, I looked it up, and since 1982, the penny has been 97.5% zinc and only 2.5% copper. But before that, and for more than 100 years, the penny was composed of 95% copper.
That was KJZZ's Phil Latzman.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Sarah Leahy. We're in Phoenix at the Ice House, and we're having a drum circle tonight. It's all like concrete, so the sound stays in the building really well and resonates. I thought it was going to be intimidating at first, and when I first got here, it was. But as soon as someone handed me a drum, I just started playing along with everyone else. It's really easy to just escape into it, just like close your eyes and listen to all the sounds and the rhythm around you. You know, you kind of hear the different melodies and beats that are going around, and you just like make your own and contribute to the music, and it's nice because it just all falls into place.
You just heard Sarah Leahy drumming with Arizona Rhythm Connection at the Ice House in Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix, Phoenix, or just think we need to get drummed out of the core, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. So what happens if we get rid of hard copies and start digitizing all of the state's records?
It's more an emotional association with the deed, the record, the diary, the photograph.
From dusty to digital, coming up on the show.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic, 60 eastbound, an accident at State Route 87. I-17 southbound, an accident on the exit ramp at the I-10 I-17 stack. And in the West Valley, an accident I-10 westbound at Watson Road. There's an ozone health watch in effect for today and tomorrow for the Phoenix area. Probably a good idea to limit your outdoor activity. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 111. Clear skies tonight with overnight lows near 90, then sunny again tomorrow with a high once again right around 111. Right now it is 111 degrees at KJZZ at 236.
KJZZ is supported by First Guarantee Financial, a financial services company specializing in retirement money preservation with strategies to protect against inflation for growth without market volatility. FirstGuaranteeFinancial.com.
When refugees flee their country, they don't just leave behind a place. They give up so many familiar things, from friends to a job to food they may have eaten every day. KJZZ's Stina Sieg introduces us to a program here in the Valley that helps ease this leap into the unknown, from the ground up.
Kofi Ogu is hunched over rows of leafy greens, snipping with his scissors as he goes.
Harvesting is something you need to do by yourself. No machine can do that.
But Ogu doesn't mind. This is his crop of malokia, a vegetable eaten in parts of Africa, including his native Togo. He's in West Phoenix on a plot of land leased through a program called New Roots, created by the nonprofit International Rescue Committee.
This program helps us rebuild our new life.
By connecting about 100 local refugees with land, seeds, and education on farming in Arizona's hot desert sun. Not that the weather bothers Ogu. He spends every day he can at his garden.
Oh, I feel like in paradise. I feel happy. especially when the crops are well.
He does sell his Molokia, mostly to other Africans nostalgic for home. But this isn't so much about money, he says, as it is about the kind of life he wishes for him, his wife, and their 7 kids.
Somebody who has like a ranch, for me, he's a king. He's like in heaven, in this earth.
That's why, even as he spent years in the military in his home country, he was always farming on the side. Hussein Alhamka, tending to his eggplants and peppers nearby, did the same thing. Except he was in the Iraqi military and has 12 children.
My kids will live better than me. It is future for my kids, this country. I like this country, yes.
You can often see his family at the Phoenix Public Market, where they sell more than 20 types of fruits and vegetables, some you can't easily get in this country. Hussein says they've never experienced prejudice there. He says people know them for their produce more than anything else.
It blocked the name of the Iraq. It's just people look at what we have in front of us on the tables.
That kind of cross-cultural connection has been one of the goals for New Roots since it began nearly 10 years ago. Over at another plot in central Phoenix, farmer Tarek Tesfar Mikel is joking with Anna Chotzen over how many bags of okra he should give her as a gift. He's from Eritrea, she is from Minnesota, and is a local foods coordinator with the program.
The farmers are really excited to tell their story for the most part, and very excited to show off their produce and sell it and have people know them for their produce.
In fact, the biggest hurdle for New Roots isn't culture shock or funding its sliding scale for farmers. It's land. New Roots technically only has the ground Chotzen and Tesfar Mikel are standing on for another year, though it's possible the lease could get extended. But even a few more years isn't enough. Not to ready the soil and build infrastructure. And that worries Tesfar Mikel, speaking through a translator.
Yeah, he's saying it should continue. If you stopped this program for especially people like me, we're gonna die.
Maybe not literally, but at 63, Tesfar Mikel is convinced that if he didn't work here, he'd waste away. No, he doesn't sell that much, he says.
But the fact that I'm coming to the garden every day to work in it, yes, that makes me really happy.
It makes his rows of bright green okra grow strong. His next goal? Onions. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
ASU will be collaborating with 3 other universities on a new engineering research center. The National Science Foundation awarded an $18.5 million grant for the Center for Biomediated and Bioinspired Geotechnics. Ed Kavazanjian is an engineering professor at ASU and will direct the new center.
Geotechnical engineering, the Brits call it ground engineering. We deal with engineering the ground so that it can support structures, so that we can tunnel through it, and so that we can recover natural resources from it. We're trying to develop a new generation of processes inspired by nature that mimic natural geologic processes that have developed over billions of years of evolution to achieve those same objectives more efficiently and more sustainably.
What are some of the practical impacts that your research could lead to finding answers to?
The first one would be geologic hazard mitigation. So that would include landslides, mudslides, and earthquake-induced liquefaction, which is a big problem, one of the first problems that we want to tackle. Liquefaction is a phenomena in the earthquakes where a saturated sand soil turns into a liquid, buildings sink into the ground, buried tanks and pipes pop up above the ground. A recent earthquake in Christchurch, a moderate earthquake, magnitude 6.3, caused billions of dollars of damage due to liquefaction. Most structures in the U.S. and around the world in liquefiable soils have not been built with consideration of the effect of liquefaction. And once the building's in place, it's very hard to remediate. If you get to a site before you build, we can fix it pretty easily. But once there's a building or utilities in place, it's very hard to stabilize the soil. We have several different technologies we're working on that would enable us to stabilize soil under an existing building without disturbing it.
It seems a little surprising that a research organization at ASU would be looking at ways to sort of help mitigate damage during earthquakes, given that this area is sort of known and lauded for the fact that it doesn't have them.
Yeah, well, you know, ASU is globally engaged. We don't address only problems that affect the Phoenix metropolitan area. You know, we look at a much broader perspective in terms of the state of Arizona, the U.S., and worldwide geologic hazards. Arizona does have earthquake hazard zones. Flagstaff, up around the Grand Canyon, is susceptible to moderate earthquakes. And if we get down to Yuma, which is adjacent to the San Andreas Fault Zone, we can have some truly large earthquakes in Yuma. And there are some areas in Yuma that have a significant risk of liquefaction in a major earthquake.
Who do you expect to use the results of this data? I mean, is this mostly like a construction company, transportation department kind of thing, or are there others that might find this useful?
Certainly, transportation agencies like ADOT, Departments of Public Works, infrastructure construction agencies, and companies would be a major consumer of our technologies. But really, any kind of civil construction, whether you're building a house or a factory or a roadway, these technologies would be applicable. And then the mining industry, they have some significant environmental problems that they need to address, restoring old mine sites, suppressing fugitive dust at mine sites. So there's a very broad range, I think, of industries, although they would all fall probably in the domain of infrastructure and environment.
Ed Kavazanjian is an ASU engineering professor. He'll be directing the new Engineering Research Center at the university. Ed, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. The show's a KJZZ original production, mixing news and features from the Valley, the region, along with national and international news. Currently partly cloudy skies, 111 degrees at KJZZ at 247.
KJZZ is supported by the Piper Center for Creative Writing at ASU. Early registration is now open for the 2016 Desert Nights Rising Stars Writers Conference, February 18th to 20th in Tempe. Faculty list and more at piper.asu.edu.
There's a lot of frustration among a relatively small group of people with what's been going on with Arizona's genealogy collection, which has been moved a few blocks from the state capitol to the Rosenbaum Archives and History Building. Some researchers are upset that they'll have easy access to a very limited number of records, but Secretary of State Michelle Reagan says digital is the way to go. For insights on not only the genealogy collection, but other issues related to hard copies versus digital, we checked in with Jim Garrison, Arizona's Historic Preservation Officer.
In the beginning, when the internet came along, there was a huge amount of skepticism about the reliability of the information. But even the real record, let's take the case of a newspaper. Mm-hmm. That newspaper, you rarely see an original newspaper. It's probably been a microfilm or some other format. And now, in the last 5 years, the digitizing of historic newspapers in Arizona, a substantial number of newspapers have been digitized through the Library of Congress. To be able to keyword search that information on your computer saves you so much time and gives you so many more sources that it's incredible now what you can do at your desk as opposed to going to a research facility. Mm-hmm. Now, you still need those primary documents. We face the same thing in our office as to what documents have to be permanent record on paper and what can be digitized, and we face this question every day as to what we're going to keep in our library, what we're going to keep in a file, what we're going to keep electronically.
Is there a reason going forward that we should still try to maintain the older records in that sort of hard copy form while we're also perhaps going into the cloud?
You never can say never that you're going to lose electronic information. And there are archival procedures now for just in case the electricity goes off and the backup doesn't work or whatever the situation is. At the same time, having this information locked away in a closet somewhere waiting for somebody to come and read it is almost as gone as much as if it's lost electronically. I mean, the amount of time something has to be used. So I think it's a delicate balance as to what you keep and what you don't keep. In my architectural practice, I've collected something like 40,000 slides. Well, those are rarely used in any format. Even my wife is saying, what are you going to do with this information you've collected over the last 40 years?
To what extent do you think it's the responsibility of a state, a municipality, whatever it may be, to preserve that? Or is it on the individual researcher, the individual who wants to know more about their family, to do more work? And I guess I feel like, what do you think the balance is there?
Well, I think the institution has a responsibility beyond individuals to collect that. I think individuals responsible for family records and diaries and important information, finding the right repository that might want to have that in their collection if the family has no use for a historic document anymore. Mm-hmm. I think it varies, but I think the institutions, and I believe in statute that these institutions are required, and all state agencies must preserve public record. I think it's an important aspect.
Will those next couple of generations feel like they're missing something if they don't have that hard, dusty copy of something? If all the information were available online, would that be good enough, do you think?
I think there is value of seeing a real, actual, real historic document. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we have the Declaration of Independence on display, you know, and protected. But at the same time, it's more an emotional association with the deed, the record, the diary, the photograph, and some of the subtleties of what you can see in original documents that sometimes aren't picked up when they're digitized. Yeah. I think it is good to have available these documents with the right protocol and the right access. And I think they should be available to as many people as they want to see them. But that's a delicate balance in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. Jim Garrison is the Arizona State Historic Preservation Officer. Jim, thanks for coming in.
Okay, very good.
Writing has changed quite a bit over the past several years. For one thing, there are more places now to write, and some of us try to sum up our thoughts in 140 characters or less. Dwayne Rowan has been thinking about the evolution of writing. He's an English professor at ASU and dean of University College and the College of Letters and Sciences.
What's really interesting about the second decade of the 21st century is that we've got all of these digital tools available to us as writers. And that's the biggest change that has occurred in the last decade or so, is that people have started to use so many digital tools that didn't exist a couple of years ago, a decade ago, and that sort of thing. And that's wonderful.
Now, when you say it's wonderful, it's interesting because a lot of folks sort of bemoan the fact that people write in, you know, abbreviations now in 140 characters. They try to write like they're tweeting at somebody or Facebooking with somebody. Is that a concern for you?
That's not a concern at all. You know, what's really interesting about this is that the more traditional forms of writing that we've been familiar with for decades are still there. People are still writing novels. Some of them are best-selling novels. Some people are writing nonfiction books, some of them bestsellers. There are still newspapers. There are still other forms of written media available. But we've now got these additional tools. And what's really wonderful about that, and that's why I use the term wonderful, is that it gives voice to people who previously would not have had access to a large audience.
As the quantity of writing has increased, what has that done to the quality of the writing?
That's a good question. You know, I mentioned just a minute ago some of the traditional forms of writing, and those kinds of writing still have the same kind of quality that they had a long time ago. But now we've got these additional kinds of writing, the tweet, for example, or some sort of post on Facebook, and those forms of writing have a different purpose. They look different, but the main thing here is, as a writer, and this is what we teach college students and high school students as well, you know, what do you want to accomplish with your writing? And given what you want to accomplish, what tools should you use to do that? So if you want to just quickly announce something that's important to you, that you want to get a message out to a lot of people, a tweet might be a great way to do that. Or if you want to say something more extended to reach a lot of people, a blog would be a great way to do that.
As more and more people are able to sort of do their own writing and not necessarily have it edited but get out to the world, is there a danger that people sort of pick up bad habits or do things that maybe they shouldn't be doing as writers?
Well, One of the things that we teach is that sometimes writing only serves the purpose of a person's learning some material. But at other times, when the writing becomes more public, then we need to pay attention to the table manners. And I use table manners to talk about things like spelling and punctuation and those things. And sometimes table manners do matter. Sometimes they don't matter at all.
Do you find that your students have writing skills that are transferable? In other words, I would imagine that many of the students you teach are very proficient at writing for Facebook and tweeting and things like that, but are they also able to write academic papers and other kinds of more maybe formal types of writing?
Well, and that's what we teach in first-year composition in a place like Arizona State University or any other college or university in the United States. And you mentioned the word transfer. We do want students to have transferable writing skills, because if they're freshmen, they're going to spend another three and a half years in college. But then they've got another 40 years of their careers ahead of them, and their personal lives will go on for another 60, 70, maybe even 80 years after that. And so we want them to see writing as something that's useful to them throughout their whole lives. And I think it's important that we keep that in mind when we teach writing, either in high school or in college.
Do you think that as writing has evolved and new forms and new platforms for writing have emerged, that's changed the way that we read also?
Absolutely. When I was an undergraduate student, writing meant putting words on paper, usually with a pencil or a pen, and then with a typewriter. And now there are all of these digital tools. So when students write, they're multimodal. They can include images easily. They can embed in their projects videos. They can embed voice recordings. You know, so as people are engaged with the text that we produce, they need to be really flexible readers and be prepared. Oh, here comes this voice recording. Here comes this image. Here comes this video recording.
Duane Rowan is a professor of English at ASU. He's also the dean of the College of Letters and Sciences and University College at ASU. Duane, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
When Valley snowbirds fly north for the summer, their houses stay here, sometimes along with valuables, electronics, maybe even a car. The trick to keeping that stuff safe?
Make the house look like it's occupied. The show's Annika Klein unlocked how the lived-in look of a home can prevent burglaries.
Deborah and Jerry Gauthier enter other people's houses.
And this one has an alarm, so I have to...
They come when no one's home, turning on faucets, opening the fridge...
And the freezer.
Where are the homeowners?
We have several Canadian people, a lot of Oregon, Minnesota, Wisconsin, you know.
The Gauthiers run a home watch service called Home Check One. Many of their clients are snowbirds who flock back north during the summer months. So Deborah and Jerry check that everything is working and inspect for bugs and leaks. They also handle curb appeal, sweep the leaves, pick up flyers, not just to keep up appearances, but also to discourage potential burglars looking for an opportunity.
They want that easy, quick grab where there's very low likelihood of them getting apprehended or observed even.
Sergeant Tim Klarkowski is with Surprise Police Department's Community Relations Unit. He says curb appeal can affect whether a home is burglarized. That's why his unit sends officers out to recently burglarized homes to see whether the home itself is inviting burglars inside.
Any sort of debris or weeds give the impression that a home is not cared for and that it's not being maintained, and potentially that it's either vacant or the residents have been gone for a while.
Klarkowski and his fellow officers give the homeowner recommendations based on an approach known as crime prevention through environmental design. It's a tactic used by other Valley departments too, and it's based on the idea that environmental cues can influence criminal behavior. A cue can be as simple as old newspapers in the driveway.
You know, if somebody sees three or four newspapers stacked up in the driveway, they're going to start to think, hey, maybe somebody's not home.
So clearing those newspapers can make a difference. The data on home burglaries in the Valley doesn't give specifics, so it's hard to know whether the appearance of the house really affects its risk of being burglarized. But another program in the West Valley has seen success firsthand. The Surprise Citizens Patrol offers a vacation watch program that maintains home exteriors for residents while they're away. They say in the 18 years of the program's efforts, only one home has been burglarized while using the services. As for the Gauthiers, there are endless little cues that make a big difference. Some of their clients have lights and even radios on timers so that they turn on and off as if someone's home. Then there's drawing the drapes, trimming the trees, even picking up the golf balls that get hit into the yard of this Sun City home.
We collect them and give them to the owners, so.
Then it's time to leave, but not without a trace. You can tell someone's been here, and that's what might keep this home safe. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
Be sure to be here tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show. We'll tell you how our use of groundwater is affecting the land above it and why are rattlesnakes back east dying. Those stories and much, much, much more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer, Sky Schatt, Maria Springs of the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. The executive producer is John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. If you have some good story ideas, let us know what's going on in your neighborhood. You can find us at the show at kjzz.org. And be sure to check out our mobile app. You can podcast the show and hear all sorts of cool stuff. It's free at the Apple Store and Google Play. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD.
KJZZ is supported by the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, hosting its Economic Outlook 2016 featuring David Brancaccio, host of Marketplace Morning Report, September 2nd, Arizona Biltmore. Information at phoenixchamber.com.